about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence with Prince, Don Nikoloff.
One, welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm Don Nikoloff, your host, and we are at December 22nd, Saturday morning on the East Coast, and still December 21st, Friday on the West Coast. And you figure out your time zone in between. Nice to have you here. We are going to go straight into our show with tonight's guest. He was with us last week. And we were discussing his upbringing in science and the unusual experiences he had and the great fortune to meet many, many accomplished scientists and people who were familiar with the work of Nikola Tesla, as well as some advanced science in the creation of various energy devices and some prototypes in the area of flying saucers. And we actually got up to the point where our guest had conducted some really interesting electrical experiments in upstate Michigan. He related a particular story that is, I think, my favorite and probably the funniest story I've ever heard, and that's witnessing this power device that he experimented with and during a violent storm that approached in the middle of winter around the Christmas season. And if you can picture lights downtown and around people's houses and people sitting around their television sets with the Christmas tree in the background, presents, and a festive holiday atmosphere. And this device that he invented basically blew out the power lines. And people described Walter Cronkite on the CBS Evening News shrinking down to the size of a postage stamp, and then his nose growing and growing until it took up the whole TV screen. Something to behold, I'm sure, and quite humorous just imagining what that would have looked like. With that, I'm going to bring tonight's guest on again. He's a well-known, well-researched scientist, author, inventor, lecturer and teacher, and I'd like to welcome tonight to Evident Footprints our guest, Jim Murray. Jim, how are you this evening?
I'm pretty good, Don. How are you doing?
I'm good. That story just cracks me up. All I have to do is think of it, and I can picture what that must have looked like on a black and white television set.
Well, naturally, I didn't see it. I was across the river causing the problem.
shame.
But anyway, I heard about it from enough people that I pieced together a pretty accurate description.
Yeah, I sort of glossed over everything that we talked about last week. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add to that before you continue on. Of course, you always have that opportunity, so...
Well, the only thing that would probably be worth adding is that my objective wasn't to disturb people's tranquility and destroy Christmas decorations. It was to take advantage of an unusual circumstance in which the Detour Power Station was offline from Sault Ste. Marie, and I could interact with it with the synchronous capacitor on almost a one-to-one level in terms of power volumes. And the object of the experiment was to essentially set up a form of resonance on the power system between Drummond Island and Detour, Michigan, and see if I could find any similarities in that arrangement, which would relate back to things described by Nikola Tesla. And, of course, the most interesting thing that happened was that when we hit the right frequency of oscillation, the diesels just went absolutely quiet as if they had no load on them. And yet the town was still brightly lit and the quarry was still operating. Of course, it didn't last very long. The cable head blew, and that got blamed on lightning. But still, it lasted probably about a minute and a half, which was long enough to demonstrate that it wasn't an anomaly. It was an actual set of circumstances that possibly could be duplicated. And that really was the foundation from which sprang the more serious work in power oscillation and energy resonance, which led to the discovery of the Dynaflux dot.
Yes, quite an interesting series of events. And now many of the listeners, have on BBS Radio have not heard this story that's coming up here in regard to your invention. I'll just let you have at it. And, even I think for those that have possibly heard this on another show, they're going to be very taken aback by this invention and what it can do.
Well, of course, it was really lingering in my mind, the effects of this experiment, because it was done on a pretty large scale of power. We had 2 5,000 horsepower post-piston diesels that were providing the electricity for this experiment. And then my synchronous capacitor, which was rated at about 800,000 VARs, and between the two of them, we were sucking some serious current back and forth to bring about this effect. And the results were striking enough that the overall thing kept turning itself over in my mind. I just had the feeling that that there was something there which needed to be brought out in a different way, but I couldn't quite get my hooks into it. And at the time, I was working with a gentleman who had been an auto mechanic in his younger days, and he had a lovely little shop building on his property, and he had allowed me to turn that into a laboratory. So I went in there early in the morning after the storm, and was bitterly cold, lit the fire, and was waiting for a place to warm up. And my friend Vern had left a package of cigarettes on the bench. And I'm not normally a smoker, but I have been known to mooch one from time to time and just puff on it, so to speak. I had nothing else to do while I was waiting for the place to warm up, and I took one of these smokes and lit it up. And I'll never forget it because it was such an unusual experience. The sun was just coming up over Lake Huron, and I was standing there looking out the window watching the effects of sunrise and puffing on this cigarette. And I noticed that the smoke that I was exhaling was making like a pattern in the sunlight. And I had seen this as a child in my father's library, where dust and little tiny particles seemed to get animated by bright sunlight. And they do some peculiar things. But anyway, this motion somehow captivated me, and I was just musing on it. And somehow that, combined with the beauty of the sunrise, just opened my consciousness in a certain way, and I suddenly understood the significance of that Popper experiment, and I realized that it could be duplicated in miniature if the same principles were used, but not necessarily the same equipment. And the idea just took a hold of me with such force that I was transfixed by the entire experience, and I could see this thing in my head. It was actually beginning to take shape, how it could be accomplished. And so in that respect, I don't know if you would call that a true vision or not, but I had a mental image of this thing before it was even built. And later that day, I drew up plans for it and started making the parts. And that turned out to be the first little Dynaflux alternator prototype. And it's just an extraordinary little device that essentially oscillates power between the mechanical source and the magnetic field in the windings in such a way that the device literally changes its complexion from being a generator to being a motor, and does this in a very controlled fashion so that it can still supply power to a load and do useful work. But the overall properties that govern its behavior are so strikingly different from those that are normally associated with a generating device that you just don't see the same results. And of course, the most exciting thing that happens is when you put a load on this little machine, the motor that you're turning it with doesn't feel that burden. And so you don't have the same relationship between the prime mover and the generator that you do in the case of standard equipment. And naturally, once I realized that this could be done, I was extraordinarily excited and very much interested in trying to commercialize the situation. And living up there in northern Michigan, as I was doing over the course of those few years, the town essentially had a population of about 500 people. That's how small it was in those days. There was no way to raise any serious money in that environment. So once I had made this discovery, I put in for a transfer in Bethlehem Steel, and they had an opening in Pennsylvania, which was a lot closer to New York and New Jersey, where I hailed from. And so they basically transferred me to a little town of Annville, Pennsylvania, where they had another quarry. And I was within maybe 2.5 hours' drive from my home, as opposed to 10 or 12-hour drive where I was located in northern Michigan. So the prospects for hunting for serious investors was greatly increased by changing this to this other location. And, of course, the story takes on a completely different flavor at that point, because even though the initial R&D had been done and something exciting was discovered, as is usually the case with any invention, if it's going to be commercialized, now you have to find someone with deep pockets and sincere interest in helping to launch the project. And so I began talking to friends around the New York area and told them I was back in the eastern part of the country and I was looking for funding for an interesting device. And by hook or by crook, I eventually was introduced to some people on Wall Street. And I got a lot of very raised eyebrows and negative reactions from a lot of them. But eventually I was introduced to a small group of guys who listened to the entire story and looked at the patent applications and kind enough to review the prototypes that I had built. And they said that they would put up the money for commercializing it. Of course, I was very excited about that. But later I found that these gentlemen were involved very intimately with the Skull and Bones organization, and the offer that they made me was one which was designed in such a way that if I had signed on the dotted line, I would essentially be giving away the technology. And so I backed out of the entire situation and preferred to do it the hard way, which is basically what I did. I started funding it on my own with my own earnings. And so at least I retained the title to the Discovery Stock.
Well, based upon the track record of Skull and Bones, they probably would have killed the project, and pun intended. I think there, you know, with those connections, what probably would have happened is they would have just put it on the shelf and let the status quo move along, or they would have militarized it. They would have gotten it into weaponry or something that would be used secretly by the government and basically quashed, you know. I don't know how else to put it, but that seems to have been the history of many of the great inventions from the late 1800s all the way up to the present.
Well, the interesting thing is these guys, they probably have it down to a science by now because, you know, getting funding for new inventions is not the easiest undertaking in the world. And if it comes to their attention that someone's looking for cash and that they have something worthwhile, they almost have their pick of the litter when it comes to new technologies. And, of course, if they do have an interest, most people who want to see their ideas utilized will take the bait, and they won't realize that they're slowly being muscled out of the picture. But luckily, I had crossed paths with some unsavory characters earlier in my career, and I just didn't like the smell of the whole situation, so I got out of it. But it wasn't without a certain amount of concern on my part, considering the characters that I was involved with. But needless to say, I persevered, and what happened next was I actually received a grant from the Franklin Institute to study the device, and it was the first serious money that was ever put into the picture, and it was for $25,000. And with that money, I built an instrumented prototype that was used to demonstrate the principle very carefully. And one of the conditions of this grant was that we work closely with a recognized authority in the field of power, who turned out to be one of the head professors at the Moore School of Electrical Engineering in Philadelphia. And he was a very cordial guy, and everything was going along very well, until we actually presented him with the finished prototype, instrumented it according to his directions, and then allowed him to preside over the final testing. And it was really interesting. He was setting the controls himself and selecting the loads to place on the generator and recording data as we proceeded. And from time to time, he'd do a spot calculation and jot down some notes. And somewhere in about the middle of the test series, he suddenly turned to me and he says, you know, this machine puts out more power than it takes to run it. And I said, well, of course it does. That's what you're involved with it for. And he said, oh, but you don't understand. That's impossible. Therefore, it must be doing something else. Well, I said, well, okay, and what's it doing then? And he said, well, I'll get back to you. I'll get back to you on that. Well, that was in 1989. I was still waiting. I haven't heard from the fellow.
Oh, my goodness. Maybe he changed his number. You know? Oh, well.
But it is remarkable, Don, when you see something that's totally outside the paradigm that you've become associated with. I think most people definitely experience some sort of a tilt sign coming on in their mind. And
Jim, let me interrupt you for a second. I think we have our first caller here on your interview. So I want to check and see who's here. Someone on the line there? Hello? Well, I guess I must have heard something else. I thought I heard someone. Well, I'm sorry I interrupted you. Do you want to continue there?
Yeah, sure. It's no problem. But anyway, I was just saying that it's a shame that people's minds are designed that way, because I think that if nothing else, this strange innate tendency to reject something because you don't understand it or don't believe it must be one of the most incredible inhibiting factors to all of human progress. And it just amazes me that it has such a powerful effect. But I watched it in action many times, and I know it's a real phenomenon.
Yes. Now, I saw the DVD presentation that you gave a while back, and it's mind-blowing to see the measurements, because you had some very sophisticated measuring equipment there, and you were getting readouts on the front end of the load and the back end, and you demonstrated it with a standard type of generator, and you put the load on this motor. Or the motor was the load, let's say, and then you got a reading, and I can't remember if it was 97% output or something like that. But when you had then used your Dynaflux, the reading went up to 315, which means that there's more power on the back end than there is going in, right?
Well, that's what the instruments convey, but in reality, that's not what happens, to be quite honest about it. What really happens is that the power changes its direction, and it flows first from source to load and then from load to source. And as a result of that, what is returned is reused. And this is something, it's the simplest thing in the world, really. I don't know why people have so much trouble with it. But they insist on embracing the old concept that electricity behaves like water, and it's just flowing through a pipe. And mm-hmm. then when you show them a demonstration like this, somehow their mind concludes that if this is true, it's like pouring 1 gallon in one end of the pipe and getting 5 gallons out the other end. And, of course, the tilt sign comes on. But it hasn't got anything to do with anything so absurd. What's actually happening is that the water in the pipe is sloshing back and forth, and the same water is being used over and over again, and so therefore the primary source of water doesn't have to supply as much on a continuing basis, and therefore the supply lasts a lot longer. And that's really all that's involved. You know, this takes us right into the realm of Tesla's concepts, because after all, he was the guy that did this first, and he was experimenting with energy resonance as opposed to frequency resonance. Not to say that he didn't make use of frequency resonance. His whole concept of radio is dependent upon that. But there are other types of resonance involved, and this energy resonance phenomenon is one in which the energy is structured in the device in such a way that the power that is required to actually run the apparatus becomes optimized and is therefore represents a minimum amount of consumption rather than a maximum amount, which is what we see in the more traditional approach to this type of stuff. And really, that's the secret of the whole thing, not only of my device, but actually of all the unexplained experiments that Tesla was doing. And, of course, the carrier for this type of phenomenon is the very same power oscillation concept, which I inadvertently employed when I destroyed the Christmas decorations in Detour. But, you know, it's not that difficult to understand.
Well, the threat to the powers that be, no pun intended there, is that they will lose money. In other words, you're making an already existing process, an invention, more efficient and more productive, and it's on the user end that this is occurring, correct? That
It is on the user end, although it doesn't have to be.
Yeah,
it can be done anywhere in the system. But here's the thing that's so interesting about it, Don. If you really employ these principles unilaterally, so that you have a large percentage, as a matter of fact, an overwhelmingly large percentage of electrical customers employing this type of approach, there will be a net benefit to the power companies as well, because when the power oscillates in the entire system, it will offload their primary generators for 50% of the time, which means that even though they have a full load on the line, they will experience the equivalent of a 50% duty cycle, which means that their fuel consumption and their other overhead costs will be cut in half, and there will be surplus power on the grid to service additional customers without building additional generating stations. But no matter how you try to explain this to people, they just don't want to hear it. So,
now,
I mean, it's strange to me because I always thought the bottom line was profit. And if you can decrease your overhead and increase your customer base without spending additional monies, or at least without spending a lot of additional money, it seems to me that that would be a very prudent way to proceed from a business point of view. But so far, haven't found anybody interested.
Now, that brings to mind, Jim, a question that I've yet to ask you about this, and I'm just picturing and recalling what you said about the synchronous capacitor experiment that you referred to a while ago. You mentioned that it ran silently. In other words, this whole electrical system that was supplying power to this whole community became silent. And I'm wondering if you were to incorporate that into today's technology as it exists and in the manner you just described, if that reduced the noise on the line, would we also experience maybe a reduction or the disappearance of what's normally called AC hum?
Well, when I say it ran silently, what I mean is if you've ever been around a large diesel engine when it's fully loaded, there's this ungodly hammering sound that it produces because of the explosions in the pistons are essentially experiencing opposition to the motion of the piston, and it produces this enormous vibration, which is like a hammering.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened when we reached this critical mode of resonance was that the hammering disappeared, and the diesels just sounded as if they were idling. So it was the noise from the generating machinery that was drastically reduced, not necessarily the electrical
AC
noise on the line.
Yeah, I'm wondering, well, we know that there's a frequency, but do you think there's a way to attenuate that noise on the end of the, you know, the electric company? In other words, they give us this power, and let's say I have my audio speakers on. Anyone who's listened to stereo in a room where maybe there's a halogen lamp or a fluorescent lamp, they seem to make noise. or they seem to attract the exact frequency where the noise is, and it produces a hum on the line. Now, that's also an indication that, there's energy which is escaping the line and even becoming audible. I mean, sometimes you'll hear this, let's say you're driving down the highway and you have your car radio on and you come near some high tension towers and you hear the hum coming off of those lines through the radio. So obviously there's a tremendous amount of electromagnetic radiation coming off of those lines. Do you have any idea if your invention reduces that or maybe narrows that band of stray frequency that's emanating off the line? I mean, we're talking about an electromagnetic phenomena, I guess.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, I have never had the opportunity to do long-term experiments on high voltage transmission lines, but I can tell you this. The sine wave, which is the basic carrier of electrical power in the existing system, essentially encourages the acceleration of electrons in the lines at the operational frequency associated with their movement. And of course, it is the acceleration of charge which produces electromagnetic radiation. Now, what's interesting about some of the stuff that Tesla did, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but he experimented at one point with very high potential DC transmission lines. And if you have pure DC going through a transmission line, most of these kind of losses are attenuated automatically. Mm-hmm. Because there is no acceleration of an electron. It's essentially traveling at a fixed velocity.
Mm-hmm.
Also, other devices, which we haven't had a chance to talk about at this point, which make use of this concept of energy resonance on a per-cycle basis, also produce square waves of power as opposed to sine waves. And they are very much less disruptive. As a matter of fact, I have an associate who has employed this concept to a very high degree of development and used it in the powering of arc-type discharge lamps. And the net result is that the lamps produce 300% more lumens per watt than they are rated for. The power consumption is down by a half, and the bulb converts so much of the electrical power into radiant energy that you can just about hold your hand on the bulb without being burned. And That's another example of a very effective and efficient manner of transforming electricity into another form of energy without the normal expected losses. So there are certainly ways of addressing those issues. It's just a question of whether or not somebody wants to really get serious about it.
Yeah, I heard recently, within the past couple of weeks, that Congress or the FCC, somebody in the government was trying to get some legislation passed to outlaw incandescent bulbs and to force us to use fluorescent bulbs, knowing that really fluorescent bulbs are not healthy for you. They're not good for your eyesight. There are a lot of associated problems health-wise with using fluorescent lighting. And you just wonder what these people are thinking of. Now, you're not talking about a modified bulb. You're just talking about the power system for it, right?
Oh, yeah, that's correct. As a matter of fact, the gentleman in question that I referred to was using store-bought bulbs that were actually designed to be used in various types of projectors and light sources for the movie industry. And his intention was to apply this modified form of power to those lamps with the intention of securing a much better response from the bulbs as a result of a judicious transformation of the energies involved. And what's interesting is they were 100% flicker-free, and they were absolutely polychromic in their spectral output, which means to say that they were almost an exact imitation of pure sunlight. And so they were extremely attractive to the movie people. The problem was that they wanted a finished product, but they weren't interested in investing money for him to scale the device up to other sizes. I forget what wattage he had demonstrated initially, but they came back and asked for a higher wattage. And he said, well, you know, it costs money to build these things. He said, if you consider an investment, then I'll definitely build you a larger unit. And it was the same old story. Even though there was an immediate need for it, somehow the idea of investing money in somebody who's inventing something seems to turn people off, and they didn't do it. As a matter of fact, they tried to steal it. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, why invest money when we can steal it, you know? Oh, well, that's an interesting concept there, and of course, we hear these stories all the time in lots of areas, not just in lighting, of course, but any invention that someone seems to make a drastic improvement on upon existing technology seems to get buried or, you know, just destroyed.
Well, sometimes it also is totally misunderstood, and people come to the wrong conclusions. I'll give you an example which I thought was rather humorous. Now, you know, at this point, there's no point in disguising the fact that I have a great admiration for Tesla and his work. The guy single-handedly gave us the 20th century, for God's sake. Everything from radio and x-rays to robotics, you know, literally came from this guy's mind. And we don't pay him any real tribute for giving us all that stuff. But it's amazing to me that regardless of what his recognized accomplishments are, the minute you move into an area of his work where people are not well informed, they always jump to an incorrect conclusion. I was recently sent a videotape by a friend of mine in New York, which depicted an effort by these two guys whose names I don't remember, but they have a show on TV called something about debunking inventions or something like that.
Yes, it's on the Discovery Channel.
And anyway, for some reason, they had decided that the story about Tesla having produced an earthquake in New York City back in the late 1890s was a lot of nonsense, and they wanted to debunk this whole thing. So they took it upon themselves to design this air-powered double-piston oscillating contraption, and then they took it to an abandoned bridge somewhere, which was slated for demolition, and they actually got permission to set this oscillator up on the bridge, and I guess the story they used was something to the effect, well, if it works, you won't have to spend the money to demolish the bridge. It'll fall down by itself, and if it doesn't work, then there's no harm done. And so they set this contraption up on the bridge and supplied compressed air to it, got it oscillating, and went around on the bridge with a stethoscope and some kind of a little vibration meter, and were very disturbed at the fact that They only experienced mild tremors here and there. The bridge didn't buckle and collapse at all. So they came to the conclusion, quite obviously, that Tesla was full of malarkey and that they knew better. They knew that he couldn't possibly have found anything that would do a thing like that. But it just so happens that after 40 years of research into this guy's work, that I could assure you that the garbage that those guys built was not based on Tesla's principle. It was based on their principle.
Well, of
and,
course.
there's no way that it would have worked. But it's interesting that they concluded that Tesla was wrong, not them.
Well, that's the propaganda machine at work there, you see. I mean, just because this show is on a particular channel that presents itself and represents itself as divulging science, the truth about science or the truth about history or whatever their topic is, I've watched that show. I think they call it something like Fact or Myth, something, you know, where they're...
Mythbusters, they're, that's what it's
called. Or Mythbusters, yeah. And they run this this disclaimer up there that, you know, don't try this at home, this might be dangerous, and then they... Oh, it's ridiculous. And they often they do this, they're not using the machined parts that Tesla would make, they're grabbing pieces of junk from a garage sale, you know, and slapping this stuff together and calling it a scientific experiment. You know, there's the police records that exist somewhere in antiquity in New York when Tesla's earthquake machine rocked the whole neighborhood there. So, you know, it never ceases to amaze me how they try to really dishonor all of his inventions by that one little bit.
Well, and the irony of it is, even though they try to dishonor the guy or defame him, they're still busy trying to duplicate what he did in secret. So
yeah.
You talk about being slightly hypocritical. It's quite amazing.
Yeah. Well, now you, so let's see, where are we now? You were...
Well, we were just getting into examples of energy resonance, and the first one that came to my mind was Tesla's earthquake experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there were others much more impressive that made use of the same principles. One of them, of course, is, his later oscillator designs incorporated this knowledge. But the most magnificent example of this technology resided in the magnifying transmitter. And what's interesting about that is I've talked to an awful lot of people that profess to be true Tesla buffs, and not anybody can tell me why he chose to describe that invention with the word magnifying transmitter. But it turns out that there's a very real reason for it, and that's because he was literally magnifying the applied power. He was making use of these kind of principles to demonstrate that power itself could be amplified, not in the way that we do it, but in the way that allows for the basic energy that's available to be utilized in such an extraordinary manner that the results are just beyond what we're capable of comprehending. And talk about records existing. There's a court case where Tesla was suing someone who tried to steal one of his transmitter designs out on Long Island. And he describes this system under oath. And he basically said something to the effect that in his devices, he can stimulate an output of several thousand horsepower with an input of just a few watts. And the attorney for the other side said, oh, of course, you're referring to instantaneous horsepower. meaning that it was done on an averaging basis.
Mm-hmm.
And Tesla said, no, I said, I'm referring to continuous power. And so even in those days, there was just no way that they could comprehend what this guy was doing. And frankly, it hasn't changed at all, even today.
Well, that's true.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, now, so where are you right now? I know that you're seeking, some backing for your device, and actually, you and I have talked about this off the air, that there may be some interested parties in this, and I'm speaking.
Well,
go ahead.
Where I am with it is that I've given up temporarily on the idea of commercializing this thing, only because it requires millions of dollars, which nobody seems to be interested in supplying at this time. And so basically what I've been doing over the last year or so is designing completely separate devices, which are essentially exploratory tools for me to put the whole process under a magnifying glass piece by piece and understand, various sections of it, which were only investigated very superficially initially. And with this and the help of some very close friends of mine, I'm hoping to be able to reduce the entire process to expressions in mathematics, which will eventually be very useful when other people attempt to understand these concepts.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the continued demonstration where you went to another part of the facilities and demonstrated higher rates of speed, I guess, or where you said if I leave this running for more than a few seconds, this thing will actually take off. And I'm wondering, are you speaking along those lines of coming up with?
Well, that device that you're referring to was a generating apparatus that was built to show some of these principles to some Japanese associates that I had who wanted to apply it to the wind industry. And what I meant by it will take off is that when you reach this critical resonance that we're describing, machines which are capable of exhibiting it have the tendency to run away out of control if you don't back off on the applied power at the right moment in time once you reach this critical performance plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, the breakers usually blow, or else there's if there's an attendant there, you can turn the thing off quickly before you reach any kind of dangerous proportions with it. But obviously, it's no worse than anything else. Once you understand all of the parameters involved, you simply build an electronic controlling device which can respond to those conditions a lot faster than a human could. And you just have the device tone itself down once it gets into that mode of operation.
I'd like to see that device. I'd like to see that device drive a TV set and maybe watch Wolf Blitzer. I'd like to see. anyway.
Still hung up on the Walter Cronkite happening, I guess.
Yeah, well, Jim, we're about out of time here. This has been very educational. I'm sure you had some more that you wanted to add to this, and, of course, we can pick up again when you join us next week. I want to thank you for coming on Evident Footprints and sharing all this wonderful, exciting scientific information with our listeners, and I look forward to the next broadcast with you.
Well, I'll be here for you, Don, and we'll just try to continue the story and explain how it unfolds and take it as far as we can.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I wish you the best, and we'll be talking to you next week. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm Don Nikoloff, your host, and I want to thank you for listening. Come back and see us again next Monday. We've got a great guest lineup for next week. Peace, love, and light. Good night. Sunrise, monster, daughter,